Illinois Public Media News.
WILL programs are made possible by the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, presenting Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors and Macbeth, plus Failure, a Love Story by Philip Dawkins from July 6th through August 10th at Ewing Manor in Bloomington. Ticket information is available at thefestival.org or 309-438-2535.
It's 12:37. Mostly sunny skies and breezy south winds prevailed across central and southeast Illinois through the morning hours. Temperatures across the area this morning at 10 were mostly in the 80s. They range from 79 at Lawrenceville to 87 degrees at Lincoln. A southerly flow will persist over the Midwest for the next several days. This will bring warm and rather humid air to the region. Thunderstorms will be common across the plains and upper Midwest, mainly west of the Mississippi River into the weekend. However, some of this activity could work east into western Illinois, especially this afternoon and again tomorrow. Most of the organized severe weather is expected to stay in Iowa and farther northwest, closer to a nearly stationary low-pressure system over the plains. High temperatures today, they'll range from the mid-70s across northern Wisconsin to the lower 90s across Missouri, southern Illinois, southern Indiana, and western Kentucky. Low temperatures tonight, they'll range from the low 60s over northern Wisconsin to the lower 70s over central Missouri and to central Illinois. Mostly sunny this afternoon around Champaign-Urbana. The high 92, mostly clear tonight with a low of 70 degrees. Mostly sunny tomorrow morning, partly sunny in the afternoon with isolated showers. The high 92 degrees and winds up to 15 miles an hour. Partly cloudy skies tomorrow night with a low of 72. Sunday, more warm conditions, the high 92 degrees. Sunday night through Wednesday, partly cloudy skies, the low 72, the high 92. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy skies, a slight chance of rain, the low 72 degrees, and looking to next Thursday, partly sunny skies. Chance of rain, the high 85 degrees. Right now in Danville, it's 89 degrees, 88 in Decatur. Down in Effingham, it's 87 degrees, 88 in Bloomington, 89 at Willard Airport, and on Friends Plaza in Urbana, 87 degrees.
WILL programming is made possible by Country Financial Representative Scott Jackson, Village at the Crossing in Champaign, committed to helping Central Illinois families achieve financial security and protect their home, family, and property since 1990. Online at scottjacksonfinancial.com.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. It's 12:40. One of Illinois' top tourist attractions is celebrating a milestone. Chicago's Museum of Science and Industry turned 80 years old Wednesday. Kathleen McCarthy is the facility's director of collections. She spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Brian O'Keefe about the museum's history and a special exhibit that celebrates the past and the future.
The Museum of Science and Industry is celebrating a pretty big birthday. Tell me the significance of the museum being around for so long.
Well, we're celebrating our 80th birthday. It's been a really great opportunity for us to showcase items, artifacts that we've collected through the years for the 80th anniversary. So we're working on an exhibit called 80 at 80. It highlights some of the museum's exciting collections from the past and then some very new items that just recently collected.
So I want to come back to those special items that are a part of this exhibit in just a second, but can you talk to me about the origins of the Museum of Science and Industry?
The Museum of Science and Industry was founded by Julius Rosenwald. He took his family on a trip to Europe in 1911, and his young son, you know how going on a family vacation and they went to museums, and he wasn't as interested until they went to the Deutsches Museum in Munich, Germany. It was a very hands-on museum, all about science and technology, and he was so excited by that visit. And Julius Rosenwald thought that Chicago, being a very important American city, needed a museum like the Deutsches, where people could go to learn about science and contemporary technology, and he referred to it as a center of industrial enlightenment that would motivate the next generation of science, engineers, doctors, and the like.
I've always been interested in this combination of science and industry. To me, it's a very interesting combination to label the museum with.
Well, in the very center of our museum, in the rotunda, around the perimeter of the large dome, there's a quote, and it says, "Science discerns the laws of nature, industry applies them to the need of man." And what Julius Rosenwald wanted was a place where people could learn scientific principles, but really he wanted to show people how those discoveries apply to their everyday life. And so he linked them together through both through that quote and in the way they presented context in the museum.
We're speaking with Kathleen McCarthy, the Director of Collections at the Museum of Science and Industry. And you mentioned a moment ago you have this exhibit for the facility's 80th birthday, and you're highlighting some items that people don't normally get to see.
80 at 80 exhibit features a broad range of artifacts from the collection, and some from the very early days of the museum, and some from as recently as last week. We are showing a broad range of artifacts, so transportation artifacts, instruments for scientific discovery, all sorts of things. So there's should have appeal to a wide audience. And what's really exciting about an exhibit like this is you see a lot of times the same kind of human ingenuity and ideas reinvented every time there's an introduction of new materials and technology. Take, for instance, one of my favorite things is called a Jones Live Map, and it dates from around 1910. So cars were relatively new, so there wasn't a lot of road signage. There weren't a lot of maps yet because not a lot of people had cars, so there was no need. So this company came up with something that looks like an oversized pocket watch that you hook to your car, and it would give you driving directions. It was a paper disc that turned a little bit like a phonographic record, and you asked the company to send you a map, essentially. It's like printed GPS. So today, you know, we have somebody in our car sitting on our dashboard telling us turn left here, turn right here. But in 1910, they had a piece of paper that slowly turned and told you turn left after crossing the railroad track, turn right past the barn. So it's nice to see that same kind of need reinvented over time.
So that's one of the earlier artifacts that's part of this exhibit. But you also mentioned just a moment ago that you have some items that are very new to the museum, such as?
Such as we have a pair of Google Glass, so which we're excited about because they are not yet available to the public. But this will be one place that the public can come and see them. And we picked them up just from Google just this last Saturday. So they're brand new, and it'll be a great opportunity for the public that is curious and doesn't happen to know one of the 8,000 people worldwide that have them, but you can come to the museum and see them.
Kathleen, last question I have for you. A museum, the caliber of the Museum of Science and Industry, always, you have an incredible collection. And this 80 at 80 highlights the fact that sometimes you have great things that you can't put on display all the time. How do curators decide what's going to be on display and what's going to be in deep storage?
The almost every museum has maybe way more things off. Yeah, not on display in storage than what's out. And there's a couple of really practical reasons for that. One is if things are light sensitive, you don't want them out all the time. So it gives you an opportunity to rotate. But it also gives us an opportunity to change the content over time. And as the museum creates new exhibits, we put out some artifacts and then we put some away, and there's always an opportunity then to get them out for exhibits like 80 at 80. The items in storage, they're always there for the next upcoming exhibit and to tell a new story and a different story.
Kathleen McCarthy, thank you so much.
Well, it's great to talk with you, and 80 at 80 will run through February 2nd, and it's included in the museum entry.
The Museum of Science and Industry's Kathleen McCarthy spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Brian O'Keefe. There's more information about the museum at its website. That's msichicago.org. The Museum of Science and Industry's founder, Julius Rosenwald, never got to see the completed museum. It opened June 19th of 1933, about 18 months after he died. It's 1247. Kenneth Turan reviews World War Z, yet another pop culture zombie apocalypse movie starring Brad Pitt.
World War Z opens with happy family scenes where Brad Pitt's character, Jerry Lane, is established as a stay-at-home dad who doesn't seem to do anything more strenuous than make pancakes for breakfast.
What is it?
Statue of Liberty or snowman?
Blackout and declared martial law.
Daddy, what's martial law?
Then, with out-of-nowhere suddenness, the world as we know it comes to an end. Infected, twitchy zombies frantically search out the living, even using their foreheads to beat against car windows, desperate to bite their victims to death. In his pre-pancake days, Jerry was the UN's top field investigator, a specialist in crisis situations, and he's asked to help track down the cause. Jerry is loath to come out of retirement. The guy really likes his pancakes, but a top military man shames him into it.
I want to send you in with the team. Help Dr. Fosbach find whatever it is he needs.
Can't help you. Can't leave my family.
Take a look around here, Mr. Lane. You want to help your family? Let's figure out how we stop this.
Jerry's investigations take him to Jerusalem, where World War Z's visual centerpiece erupts on screen. One by one, hundreds of zombies form an angry horde that swarms into an immense pyramid, allowing the undead to surmount a massive protecting wall. That manic movement is the most unexpected part of World War Z. Much of this film is zombie business as usual, with Pitt in full save-the-world mode, but it's fun to see this familiar material done with intelligence and skill. Why are zombies so omnipresent today? In a world where we all feel more threatened than we ever have by a myriad of forces beyond our control, from global warming to spying governments, it's comforting, perhaps, to see the personification of these fears in creatures that also cannot be stopped. Unless Brad Pitt does the stopping.
NPR film critic Kenneth Turan.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Meadows Edge at Clark Lindsay, a new community to be located adjacent to Meadowbrook Park on the east side of the Clark Lindsay campus. Meadows Edge will offer villa accommodations for active adults looking for condo-style homes. Learn more at clark-lindsay.com.
And here's the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 21st of June, 2013. Today is the summer solstice and the first day of summer in the Northern Hemisphere, the longest day and the shortest night of the year. It's the birthday of philosopher and writer Jean-Paul Sartre, a giant in the school of existential thought. Sartre was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1964, but he refused it in principle. When he died in 1980, 50,000 people turned out on the streets of Paris to pay their respects. And it's the birthday of novelist Ian McEwan, born in Aldershot, England, 1948. His father, a working-class Scot, worked his way up to officer's rank in the army, so the boy grew up all over the world, including Singapore, Germany, and Libya. He later said, "It was a very fractured background in that respect, and I think my early fiction was unlike mainstream British fiction in that it wasn't located in place. I had not come from the usual roots of the English class or educational system. I must be the only writer in Britain who did not go to Oxford." McEwan also said, "Contemporary English fiction was so nicely modulated and full of observation about class and furniture. I wanted more vivid colors. I wanted something savage." So he filled his first book, First Love, Last Rites, with short stories about incest, infanticide, and bestiality. Critics in England were so shocked and startled, they began calling Ian McEwan Ian Macabre. And it's the birthday of American critic and novelist Mary McCarthy, born in Seattle in 1912. Both of her parents died from a flu epidemic in 1918 when she was only six. She and her three younger brothers were sent to Minneapolis to live with a couple whom McCarthy described as a severe great aunt and her sadistic husband. She graduated from Vassar, wrote book reviews, then became a theater critic and editor of Partisan Review. In 1938, she left her lover, Philip Robb, to marry literary critic Edmund Wilson. In her autobiography, Memoirs of a Catholic Girlhood, she focused on the horrible early years at her abusive uncle and aunt's Minneapolis house, and then her happier adolescent years in Seattle. Later, she published The Group, about eight recent Vassar graduates, which stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for nearly 2 years. McCarthy had a fierce feud with the playwright and memoirist Lillian Hellman, whose birthday happened to be the day before hers. They traded catty remarks in the press, and on The Dick Cavett Show, McCarthy famously said about Hellman, "Every word she writes is a lie, including and the." Hellman sued her, but died before the suit was settled.